Amen. Thank you, sir. Well, I said in the first service, and I'll say it again, there are Sundays when we get done with the singing part of our worship, and I'm tempted to just go like, all right, we're done. That's it. Pass the plates, say the prayer. Thank you guys for leading us so well this morning in worshiping the Lord. So here we are, about to start Isaiah chapter 2 already, and if you remember correctly, Isaiah chapter 1 is kind of the State of the Union address. God has come before Israel and gives them a State of the Union. And unlike what I assume every president, everyone I've ever seen, State of the Union addresses, that the president ends by saying the State of the Union is strong, here God has said the State of the Union is utterly broken. That's bad news. Your efforts towards me are purely hypocrisy. You have rejected me. One of the things we see in Isaiah is, I think this is part of where C.S. Lewis gets his idea of God being a gentleman, meaning I will not force myself on you in this way. You have rejected me, so we'll go with that. And that's where they are in this covenant. God is going to start the process of unpacking the consequences. Here's what's coming because of this. Isaiah chapter 2 is a prophetic poem about a mountain river and a day. So we're going to pick there, and by the way, the unifier is, it is the mountain of the Lord, and it is the day of the Lord. So come, let us river up to the mountain together. Isaiah chapter 2, the word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem shall come to pass in the latter days, that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between the nations and shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. For you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of things from the east and of fortune tellers like the Philistines. And they strike hands with the children of foreigners. Their land is filled with silver and gold, and there is no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with horses, and there is no end to their chariots. Their land is filled with idols, and they bow down to the works of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. So man is humbled, and each one is brought low. Do not forgive them. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of man shall be exalted. And the Lord alone shall be exalted on that day. And for the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, and against all the oaks of Bashan. Against all the lofty mountains and against all the uplifted hills, against every high tower and against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish and against all the beautiful craft. And the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the lofty pride of men shall be brought low, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day. And the idols shall utterly pass away, and the people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. In that day, mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship to the moles and the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs from before the terror of the Lord, and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. Stop regarding man in whose nostrils is breath, for of what account is he? The very words of God. You can tell from that reading, this is going to be a doozy today, right? So let's start unpacking this passage. Chapter 2 begins with a reminder, but also a clarifier, the word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. This is still a word revealed to Isaiah, just like we learned from the beginning of chapter 1, but this is a specific thing. So if you're in your Bible, it may say an oracle or a prophecy or a word. So what seems to be happening in the book of Isaiah is that there are moments when God kind of gets Isaiah's attention somehow. I don't know if Isaiah goes into a quiet room by himself, and then God says, okay, I have a message for my people. Here it is. And that message, I don't know how it works. We don't know how it works. Was it just God spoke it and Isaiah wrote it down? Did God show him something and Isaiah noted it? Was it that he wrote it down and then added his own commentary in on what he thinks is going on? It seems to be something of a conversation between Isaiah and God in places, even as we will see in this chapter. But whatever it is, and this oracle, this moment of prophecy, this kind of segment of prophecy is going to last probably until chapter 5. So we'll be looking at this same moment, whatever this was for Isaiah, for several weeks. We're going to see two phrases that I want to draw attention to here at the beginning. First is the phrase, "It shall come to pass." Now, in prophetic language, this is significant. In other words, someday in the future. Not saying how long, but someday in the future. This will happen. And we know from our birth pains analogy that Jesus gives us in Matthew that it's going to happen probably several times in the future. It's going to happen and it's going to happen again. It's going to happen again. This will come to pass. Some of you apparently really appreciated that analogy that I gave, the idea of traveling to Tuscaloosa, because I have received two or maybe even three different photographs of the Mississippi River Bridge since I did that. And people are like, "Wow, you're not kidding. This is a big bridge." So yeah, exactly. So it shall come to pass someday in the future. And then the other phrase, and he's going to link them together right here, is in the latter days. So again, imagine if you're counting this direction and he says it will come to pass. If you're moving this direction, this is going to come to pass. And so these are going to be some things you're going to see moving forward. But he also gives some warnings, and there are some signs that the trip is nearly done. That would be like when I said you're going to start seeing signs for the exit for Tuscaloosa. That right at the end, you're going to see some things. And he's saying in the latter days, meaning near the end, right at the end, you're going to see some things as well. He's going to use those concepts here at several times, but right here, we're going to get them right together. It shall come to pass, verse 2, in the latter days. So this is something near the end that we're going to get to. That the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and the nations shall flow to it. And many people shall come and say, "Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." All right, so clear imagery here of a mountain stream. But what's interesting about this mountain stream is that it runs two ways. Certain things flow in and certain things flow out. And so it's an interesting imagery there. So this phrase, "Come, let us go up," flowing up into the mountain. And then certain things flow out. From the mountain, for example, will flow the law, the word of the Lord. Let's see what else. He shall judge, verse 4, he shall judge between the nations. So people flow in to be judged. He will judge between the nations. He shall decide disputes for many peoples, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. If you're a YouTube fan, you recognize that last phrase. That was one of the things they liked to talk about at their concerts, was this idea of there coming a day when man would learn war, not anymore. People flow up to face judgment and settlement. They flow back with peace and justice. And this peace and justice begins to spread out into the world. War will come to an end. In fact, even the preparation for war shall come to an end. People don't prepare for war, and eventually the resources used to prepare for war will not be needed. It's a obvious reversal of 1 Samuel chapter 13. So in 1 Samuel chapter 13, many of you know this is a key passage in my ministry and my understanding of ministry. In 1 Samuel chapter 13, the people of Israel have finally gotten themselves a king. And they're super proud of this. They want a king from God. And they've got this really compelling argument. Their compelling argument that they don't want to be ruled directly by God anymore. They don't want to be ruled by prophets and priests who are communion directly with God. They want a king, and their argument is, well, everybody else has a king. That's their whole argument. And God says, fine. He had predicted that way back in Deuteronomy, predicted this would happen. And so sure enough, now it's happened. And the human king Saul, God gives them this king that he gives them according probably to the standards he knows they want. He's impressive. He's, for example, tall. And so they're proud of this. They love this. So he guides them there. And God predicted to them, listen, the minute you get a king, you also get war from now on. That's how kings work. What kings do is they take your sons and they take your resources and they go to war. And from that time, the nation of Israel, when it has been a nation, has been preparing for war 24/7. Every day, all day, their sons and their daughters all conscripted into the military. Their budget to protect them from the enemies they are surrounded by, that started 3,000 years ago. Here we have, this passage is so key. What you have is, so the minute the Philistines hear that the people of Israel have a king and are declaring themselves independent, the people of Israel say, you know what we need? We need to take all our swords and we need to take all our spears and we need to sharpen those things. So everybody go back and get your swords and spears so we can take them out and get ready for war. And they discover they have a problem. They don't have any swords or spears. No one does. In the entire nation of Israel, there are two swords. So they go, well, okay, we got a problem then. We need to turn our plowshares, our farming implements, into weapons. I've gotten a lot of use out of this now over the years. He made this for me. This is two plowshares that Paul found on this property. And this is what a plowshare looks like. And he took the other one and heated and hammered it into a sword. It's a pretty cool concept. So they discover, okay, we need to do that. We need to take our plowshares and turn them into swords. And then they discover they have a much, much bigger problem, which is they have no blacksmiths. The reason that's a passion for me in ministry is that's where I get most excited about ministry, is to discover where the church is now, not only without sword, but we may not even have many blacksmiths left. And it's time for us to catch on to that and shore that up. That's one of the pictures I think is so powerful. Well, imagine, so when you look at this, this is the moment when they realize it. 1 Samuel 13, starting in verse 19, that there was now no blacksmith to be found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make themselves swords or spears. So the Philistines knew exactly what they were doing. So in the moment of great humiliation, maybe one of the most humiliating moments in all of human history, so the Israelites went down to the Philistines to sharpen their plowshares, their mattock, his axe, or his sickle. And the charge was 2/3 of a shekel for a plowshare and for the mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for sharpening the axes and for setting the goads. So on the day of the battle, there was neither sword nor spear found in the hands of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan, but Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them. So imagine, for 3,000 years, these people have been preparing for war. But look back at verse 2. It's not just the nation of Israel. It shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the house of the Lord shall be established as the highest of the mountains and shall be lifted up above the hills, and all the nations shall flow to it. So it isn't just Israel that no longer has to prepare for war. It is all of the nations, the entire world. No more war. Now listen, not everything about war is bad, as people who have been in it know. There's camaraderie and courage and innovation and sacrifice that is revealed in war that may not be revealed hardly anyplace else. But imagine when God creates a world in which the good that comes from war can happen without all the horrors that come from war. For now, the world will continue to spend probably at least, which was this last year, $2.71 trillion a year to prepare to fight each other. Compare that to the $265 billion that is spent on addressing world hunger. $265 billion for hunger, $2.71 trillion for war. That's where we are. Instead, we now get this reversal, this beautiful reversal where God says, no, no, the sword, it's time to bend it back into a plow. Because the sword is needed no more. It's a beautiful thing. What a blessing to the people. Instead, there's another invitation that follows. And I think this is now Isaiah's heart coming through. O house of Jacob, come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Already, Isaiah is saying, can you imagine what it would be like not to fight anymore, not to prepare for war anymore? Jacob, come on, now. Let's start now. Your future is so bright if you walk in the light. Come, we have already read. Come, let us reason together. Come, let us go up to the mountain. And here we have another invitation. Come, let us walk in the light of the Lord. We're going to see more of them in Isaiah. Come, my people, enter your chambers. Come out to me and let each eat from his own vine. God is a God of invitations. What a cool thing about that. What a fascinating trait for an all-powerful God who needs nothing. Who needs nothing. He needs nothing from us. He needs nothing at all. He is fully sufficient. What kind of a God then also says, but I want you. Come. A God of invitations. It's an amazing picture. Again, if you're still stuck in that simplistic understanding of the Old Testament God as purely just a God of wrath, a one-dimensional God of wrath, you're missing it. We're going to see over and over again through Isaiah that God is not this one. There's not two gods. There's not the one-dimensional God of wrath in the Old Testament. It's some kind of hippie God in the New Testament. It's the truth is there is one God, and all of these are parts of who he is. Now, Isaiah begins to speak from his own perspective rather than God's, but he's speaking to God. So now it's turned into kind of a conversation. The people you have invited have rejected you, so you are rejecting them. Verse 6, you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of things from the east and of fortune tellers like the Philistines. They strike hands with the children of foreigners. This is meant to be something that, so we probably miss this. So if you don't know, obviously most of the world, if you think of where Israel is, to its west is pretty much immediately the Mediterranean Sea. To the east, there's a lot of countries. There's Assyria at this time, Babylon, Persia. They're all over there to the east. And he's like, listen, you guys have looked to the east to solve all these things. You've got all these religious things that you picked up from, these evils that you picked up from the people to your east. And somehow, so here's the thing, Philistia is just a handful of cities that run just down the coastline of the Mediterranean. That's why they're always fighting each other, right there together, just down the coastline. There's this narrow strip that's called Philistia, where, like, for example, the Gaza Strip is. And so God is saying, Isaiah is saying, you've rejected them because somehow not only have they managed to find evils to embrace from the east, but they're so good at this, they've even found some ways to find evils in that tiny strip of land to their west. Where do they find evils? Only to their left and their right. That's how fallen and broken and rebellious these people are. So you have rejected them because they are, to put it mildly, full of it. That's what we're going to see, is this full of it language. What are they full of? The lands there are full of it. The evils of the east and from the west. False and evil religious practices. And these lands are full of it too. It's verse 7. Their land is filled with silver and gold. There's no end to their treasures. Their land is filled with chariots. There's no end, filled with horses. There's no end to their chariots. Now, that didn't sound so bad. Full of silver and gold. Horses and chariots. Power and wealth. But as a good Jewish audience, of course, we remember that these are exactly the very things that God told the kings of Israel to not collect. Look at Deuteronomy 17. This is two of the three things they were told. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. And he shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. In fact, the kings of Israel were supposed to write this whole thing, this whole section of scripture down when they became. And then the priests were supposed to check it to make sure they got it right. If any of the kings of Israel did this, we have no record of it. They probably ignored it. Power and wealth can cause us to regard ourselves, to trust ourselves, to ignore the giver of all good things. In his lectures about Abraham Lincoln, Robert Ingersoll once said this, "Nothing discloses real character like the use of power. It is easy for the weak to be gentle. Most people can bear adversity. But if you wish to know what a man really is, give him power." Power and wealth can reveal what Jeremiah describes as our wicked and deceitful hearts. But in addition to these temptations, wealth, and power, they are full of yet more. Verse 8, their land is filled with idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their own fingers have made. I'm going to pause there for real quick and just mention, we're going to see in Isaiah this dichotomy between the pagan religions, I'll reference here in a second, which we are warned, they are warned against. Stay away from the pagan religions. Stay away from the seeking after power through spiritual beings, because it's evil, wicked, dangerous. Don't mess with this stuff. It's dangerous. But about idolatry, God is going to reveal through Isaiah that it's just stupid. What are you thinking? We're going to come to a point where Isaiah, where God mocks the idea that he says, so you cut down a piece, let me understand this. You cut down a piece of wood, and then you cut it in half, and half you then hand carved into an idol to worship, and the other half you cut into pieces to cook your stew with. Am I following? You literally just made that with your own hands, and now you're going to worship it? That's just ridiculous, right? Why would anyone do this? So man is humbled and each one is brought low. Do not forgive them. Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty. These false gods, the dangerous game of paganism, are the foolishness of idolatry. Consider just for a second, consider how foolish it is that something that we make with our own hands, our own little advances that we make, that we would then take the time to constantly be at the beck and call of something that we made. To constantly be bowing and worshiping that. Hold on a second, I got a notification. Sorry. I'm just picking. All right, I got to move on. I'm going to be challenging myself there. But they're full of one more thing. Themselves. Verse 11. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of men shall be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted on that day. Okay, we've just hit an important phrase in the book of Isaiah. It isn't fully time to realize it yet, to analyze it yet, but we're going to start here. It's as if at this moment Isaiah quotes this, uses this word, hu yom. Hu yom, that day. And then Isaiah goes, oh, you know what? I probably ought to explain to you what I mean by that day. I guess I should explain that. This first look at that day here in Isaiah chapter 2 is going to emphasize what that day is against, what it is opposed to, what it comes into existence to change. Verse 12, for the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up, and it shall be brought low. Against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up. Against all the oaks of Bashan. Against all the lofty mountains and against all the uplifted hills. Against every high tower and against every fortified wall. Against all the ships of Tarshish and against all the beautiful craft. And the haughtiness of man shall be humbled and the lofty pride of men shall be brought low. And the Lord alone will be exalted on that day. This day, Hu Yom, it will be against anything that even represents self-exaltation. Exalt just means to lift it up, right? Against anything that is exalted. The imagery starts like with just anything high and lifted up. Mountains, great trees, even technological things that humans build that are high and lifted up. Towers and the masts of ships. But I think these are the imagery because the real target is revealed as the pride of man. Anything that puffs us up, anything that makes us feel, well, high and mighty. And I want to take a second. What makes you feel high and mighty? What makes you feel superior? What do you want to present to the world as the best thing about you? Is it your intellect? Is it your physique? Is it your technology? Is it your accomplishments? There is a day coming when God will take everything that is exalted and he will lay it in the dirt. That day is coming. This is an important application that, like I said last time, we might as well get ahead of the application because it's coming for many, many chapters unrelentingly, and that is this. What does pride look like in you? What does pride look like in me? I think we're unique in the way that we inject our veins with pride. The dependence that we have on it, I think, is unique. That we do it is not unique, it's universal. Every single one of us is infected with pride. Every single one of us is tempted by pride, wants to lean on our pride. It may be in something very different than me, it may be in a way that is very different from me. But I think that is true for every one of us. And so I think the question, as I looked at this chapter and then even hearing other teachers reference this, the key to us making application today, one of the most important applications is to know ourselves well enough to know, where is my pride? Now, I'm not talking about the normal healthy versions of being proud of a friend or a family member or whatever. That's the healthy sense of like, man, you are my son and I'm well pleased. That's healthy. It is the this is what makes me special. This is what makes me valuable. This is what makes me admirable, is my fill in the blank. That's where pride is. If anything in your heart is founded on anything other than God, what it is founded on is pride. Where do I find my identity? Even when I'm thinking of the future, when I say like, oh, someday when I am loved by the right person, when I'm chosen by the right person, when I have set aside whatever money that it is, that's just premeditated pride. If we go, oh yeah, I'm a loser now, but man, when this happens, then I'll be something special. That's premeditated pride. Even tearing ourselves down can be a version of pride. Even saying, oh, I'm just worthless and I've got nothing to offer and it's because it still is I, me. It's still somehow my value is founded and based in me, even if it's low. That's still a version of self-exaltation, meaning I'm somehow important enough to determine my own value, even if it's low. I know that's weird. If you don't yet know what pride looks like in you, you need to know, because it's there. Now, I would say, if you aren't sure what pride looks like in you, ask someone in your family, because they know. But honestly, if you're the kind of person who doesn't know what pride looks like in you, they may be too afraid to tell you. You may be too scary or too brittle to tell. So you may have to find a friend who loves you but doesn't fear you enough to tell you. We all need people like that in our lives. We need the people who love us enough and who don't fear us to tell us. We're all terrible at this. We should all be able to kind of gather up in a big huddle and go, hey, help me understand my pride, because it's all there. We'll talk more about this in a second. But if you don't know how to repent specifically about your pride, then you're missing something. His description of Huyam continues. Verse 18, and the idols shall utterly pass away, and people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes in the ground from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. Now, I'm going to take a minute and just that word terror. That's a good word, but it probably is misconstrued by us. We think of terror through the lens of terrorism. So terrorism is what the non-powerful party does. All they can do is create fear, right? A bunch of Afghani tribesmen can't go toe-to-toe with the American military out on an open plain, so they create, instead of battle, they create terror. It's because they're weaker. That is not what's being described here at all. This is not the petty terrorism of creating fear. Probably the better translation here for us today is dread. This is the dread that a child experiences with the phrase, just wait till your dad gets home. Okay? Even if it's a loving dad who they know loves them, they just do not want to experience the consequences that they know are coming when dad gets home. Hopefully that's not about wrath and age and rage and anger, but is about power and consequences. Those handful of you who are old enough to remember the principal saying, do you want pops or do you want me to call your dad? That's dread, especially if you chose pops, like I always did, right? Like this type of dread. I'm afraid I'm going to be hurt by them or broken by them or harmed by them. I just do not want to face the consequences of that just wrath. That's where it is. That's what's being described in the word terror here. So again, not the pathetic kind of behind the scenes, ooh, I'm just trying to make you feel really scared. It's not like that. He has no reason to hide. It is up front. He's even telling you. But notice the key here. From exalted, high and lifted up, self-exalted, not just down to the dust, as he said earlier, but now below the dust, the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground. It's even more. And by the way, he's now going to repeat this phrase. He's going to repeat almost identical a little phrase here, almost of what he just said. And in Hebrew, especially in poetry and prophecy, to repeat means to draw attention to it. It means emphasis. So again, the idols shall utterly pass away. The people shall enter the caves of the rocks and the holes of the ground from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. Verse 20, in that day mankind will cast away their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they made for themselves to worship to the moles and the bats, to enter the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of his majesty when he rises to terrify the earth. See how those are almost identical. If you're throwing your idol, by the way, they're trying to get rid of those idols. They don't want to get caught with them. This is the criminal running, throwing away the weaponry, throwing away the drugs while they're running from the cops, right? They don't want to get caught with these idols when the Lord appears, so they're throwing them. But who are they throwing them to? Bats and moles. So where are they? Under the ground. They're not just in the dust. They're now under the dust. From soaring with the eagles in the clouds of self-pride to hiding in the caves with the moles and the bats. Isaiah will return dozens, maybe more times to this phrase, hu yom. But this is the first color of the paint by numbers as we will continue to examine the phrase, that day. We'll return to it. But for now, what's the conclusion here? Now, those who know me know that, like most old men, I have started the process of saying kind of the same things over and over again, right? That over time, there are certain truths that have become more important to me, more real to me, more clearly true to me, and all the other kind of stuff becomes less and less important, and these keys become more and more important. I think that's what's happening. I guess I should say I hope that's what's happening, right? When I was younger, I was fascinated by the philosophy of humanism because I've always thought humans are fascinating. I think we're kind of amazing in some ways. I think there's so much to learn. It's just amazing how complicated we are, our personalities and our thinking and the way we engage in relationships. And I've always just thought that was really cool and amazing. So I've always been fascinated by this idea of humanism. So I'm going to define it correctly, make sure. Humanism is the philosophy, it is the basic faith in the human race to offer sufficient meaning, sufficient purpose, and to solve all of the problems that we have created. Now, I will also tell you, as a psychologist, if you're going to the source of your problems to offer the solution to your problems, you're choosing badly, right? Listen, you dumped him, move along. Don't go back. I've found certain truths like this to be more clear. These seem, humanism only seems more tragic and more ridiculous the longer that I am alive. It doesn't get any better. And you guys know that. You know that I think that. If you've been here long, when I hear people talk about their decision or even just their temptation to trust in themselves. Now, just to clarify, they don't say that. What they say is, I just need to follow my heart. What they say is, hey, you know what? Just be yourself. And every time I hear that, I want to say, have you met you? Right? Like, just be yourself. You might want to bring a little more than that to the table, my friend. Like, when you're telling your son, like, hey, on this first date, just be yourself. I'm going to be like, here, I'm going to tell you, I'm going to encourage you something. Do your best to be Jesus. I think that's a better choice than you. I've met you, and listen, I love you. But I think the degree to which you can model Jesus in your relationship, it's better for her and you, right? That's what we're looking at. This seems only more tragic. I love, this has now become one of my favorite quotes, the Spurgeon quote. I'm falling, really, really starting to like Spurgeon a lot more. This is new favorite. If any man thinks ill of you, do not be angry with him, for you are worse than he thinks you to be. Let this set you free of criticism for the rest of your life. If anyone criticizes you, you should always breathe a sigh of relief. Oh, that's all you've got to say? Man, if you knew, man, that's nothing, right? This is I promise you're worse than anyone knows that you are. Inside of your own head, you know what's going on up there. And if you could do that, there's actually a philosophical experiment, a thought question, which is, if we could all read each other's thoughts all the time, what would society be like? And pretty much everyone agrees, there wouldn't be any of us, right? We wouldn't have any society at all. We're that broken. We need someone else other than us to save us. And so I'm so glad, having met us and realizing we need something else, I'm glad to discover that we're in good company, not only with Spurgeon, but with Isaiah when we say that. Here's how Isaiah says it in verse 22. Stop regarding man. Stop regarding man in whose nostrils is breath, for of what account is he? Now, that sounds strangely written, doesn't it? Sounds a little weird. Listen, as humans, it is true that we are fearfully and wonderfully made. We are fantastic creations created in the image of God. I'm not anti-human. I just have a low anthropology. I don't think we're that impressive, except for the things that God has made impressive about us. Fantastic creations created in the work in the image of God. We are his artwork. Poema is the word that's used in Ephesians chapter 2:10. Whatever you memorized, craftsmanship, workmanship, doesn't do it justice. Poema, the material created by an artist. That's us. When God wants us to see his power, he says, look to the night sky. Look at those giant balls of a fusion reaction that I sent spinning about in space. I named them, I formed them, and I spun them out there. That is power in a way you can't even comprehend. But when he says you want to see him as an artist, he says, look in a mirror. We are created in his image. Not physically, of course, but in our creation, our very root of our identity, we are his, created in his image. It's a beautiful picture. This is why I think, to paraphrase Lewis, the truth of this is enough to raise the head of every sinner and humble the heart of any saint or any king. This is us. But it's also true that we may become more technologically advanced, but if I may say it this way, we are not going to get more good. Not on our own. Any study of history will show you this. We're not getting any more good. This passage, weirdly worded, is clearly that Isaiah is referencing Genesis 2:7. Stop regarding man who cannot even give himself breath. How powerless are you? You cannot even give yourself breath. Genesis 2:7, instead, we should start regarding the Lord who formed the man of dust from the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. We should be regarding the one who gave us breath, not the one doing the breathing. We don't honor art for the art's sake. We honor art for the artist's sake. Well, we get to do this now. What then? Let's do the old callback. A theme that is showing up over and over again, the God of the New Testament and the God of the Old Testament, it's the same one that we get to meet in both. And in this case, the callback I want us to focus on is this: God is a God of invitation. How cool and comforting that even in a book of confrontation and condemnation, that the first half of Isaiah is bracketed by invitations. And of course, the New Testament is filled with similar invitations. You can be thinking about that for a couple of seconds before I read some of them out to you. But to recognize this, think about the passages that in which Jesus says things that begin with come. So my invitation to you is come, confess your pride. Be humble enough to trust him to save you forever if you've never done that. Confess your pride. You cannot save yourself. Have you met you? Not likely to work out well. And if he has saved you forever, then to trust him enough to turn and follow his path to give purpose to our lives. So if you will, stand with me. Speaking of invitations, as we take a moment now and focus our attention in, listen to these different references by Christ. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden. If any man is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Come and see. Come and dine. Come take up your cross and follow me. Let the little children come to me. Come to a desert place and rest a while. All that come to me, I will not cast out. And this final one from Matthew 25. Listen, as we do this time of invitation, if you need to come down here, sometimes we need the physical representation of kneeling before God. Yes, we can pray anywhere, we can confess anywhere, but sometimes we need that physical representation of coming. These who are up here would love to pray with you. If you want to beg before God something that you're begging, I know many of you are facing heartbreak right now, then you need to come and cry with someone and beg God for relief or mercy. Come. If you want to come up here and celebrate with somebody or kneel here at this stage and pray that God would you could celebrate with him, to thank him for some amazing good thing, or these guys would love to do that with you as well. If you need to come and and find rest and salvation in Him, we would love to talk with you and pray with you about that too. If you just need to come because you've already been through the welcome home process and you're ready to be a part of our dysfunctional church, dysfunctional family, we would love for you to come. It's not an expression of, we're not somehow admitting abuse to that. We're saying, listen, we're broken like you are. We'd love for you to be a part of it. The last little verse here we'll wrap up with. Matthew 25, starting verse 31. When the Son of Man comes in His glory and all the angels with Him, then He will sit in His glorious throne. Before Him will be gathered all the nations, and He will separate people from one another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And He will place the sheep on His right and the goats on His left. Then the King will say to those on His right, come, you who are blessed by My Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. The very word of God.